This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 152 was recorded on January 31st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Grant Williams returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from what's next for global equity markets to European exit contagion to populism and social unrest. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when macro tourist blogger and East-West Investment Management portfolio manager Kevin Muir will join us to discuss his recent piece on modern monetary theory, which has begun to go viral on the internet after being featured on Zero Hedge.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we even get into equities, let's start this week off with the guidance from the Fed. What happened this week and what should we conclude?
Well, the Fed surprised everyone and said that the next policy rate action could be either up or down, and also expressed an accommodative stance on ending balance sheet reduction sooner than previously communicated. Now, this is huge news because, frankly, if I talk to all of our guests at Macro Voices Live and there was some disagreement about things like the direction of gold and the direction of the dollar, there really wasn't that much disagreement on those things. The disagreement was on whether or not there was a real chance of the Fed backing away from quantitative tightening. And when you had someone like Brent Johnson express just a really, really bullish view on the dollar, that was predicated on his view that there's no way that the Fed was going to back away from quantitative tightening. So the real change here that surprised a lot of us is the Fed's change in policy stance. And that really forces all of us to revisit our views on the dollar, gold, equities, and so many other things that were predicated on a belief system about what the Fed would do in terms of Jay Powell really made it pretty clear in the beginning of his term as Fed chairman. He says, look, it is not our job to respond to markets by changing policy to accommodate the stock market. That's not what we're here for. Well, maybe it's not what they're there for, but it's what they're doing suddenly. And that really changes things. So now all indications are that the hiking cycle is not just paused or pausing, but perhaps it's over. And furthermore, that quantitative tightening is likely to be curtailed. When the facts change, we have to change our views. So I'm reevaluating my dollar and gold outlook. I'd love to get Brent Johnson back on the program soon so that we can follow up on the conversation we had at Macro Voices Live about Luke Groman's view. In that conversation, Brent expressed the view that Luke would be proven right in the long term, but there's no way he's going to be proven right in the short term because there's no way the Fed's going to ever back away from the commitment they've made to quantitative tightening. Well, needless to say, the Fed has surprised me and I suspect Brent as well, and it's time for all of us to revisit our views. So I'd be very curious to get an update from Luke Groman, from Brent Johnson, and from several other people. Bottom line, the picture has changed. Short term, this definitely means more upside in equities and gold, and it means more downside risk for the dollar. But frankly, Patrick, I think that the consensus really has the wrong conclusion. Everybody is jumping for joy. The bulls are screaming for new all-time highs or in their sights again. What this really means when you stop and think about it is that Bernanke was wrong when he claimed that the Fed would have no trouble mopping up all of this liquidity that's being created. The Fed has caught themselves in a trap where they cannot stay the course on policy and get us to the point where they've rebuilt enough ammunition to defend against the next crisis, because trying to build up that ammunition is causing a market tantrum. It's a market tantrum that a lot of people predicted. It's a market tantrum that Jay Powell said he was not going to cave to if it happened. But when it happened, actually, he kind of did cave to it. At least that's my interpretation of this week's events. Bottom line conclusion is that I still think there is a lot more downside, because eventually what we've got to come to terms with is that the Fed is trapped here and they're starting to run out of options. But in the short term, they've just announced a radical dovish pivot to a much more accommodative stance than we thought. That has to mean short-term upside in the market.
Well, I couldn't agree more, because the dovish pivot there has really been the short-term fuel that's pushed the S&P 500 up to this 2,700 handle up on the upside. What's your thinking here, though? I mean, does this thing target 2,800 under this news, or what's in store for the S&P 500 in your mind?
Well, you know, it was interesting to me that so many people on Twitter were kind of shaming Charlie McElligot, saying, you know, he totally missed it and blew the call. I would say the exact opposite. I think Charlie perfectly nailed the call when we had him on the program recently. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. What Charlie said is that we were likely to see a short-term top around January 18th. He nailed that call. That's exactly when it happened. He said aggressive selling could follow. That happened too. Now, back when he was on the program, he predicted that that selling could last as long as January 31st or February 1st, in other words, today or tomorrow. And at that point, he predicted a resumption to the upside as corporate buybacks came back into the picture after their earnings reporting window expired and they were able to get back into that. It was only in the short term he was predicting that sell-off. And for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to read his daily letter, he's been changing his tune as the facts have been changing. By the morning of Wednesday morning, January 30th, before the Fed announcement and before the big market move came up, Charlie had a letter out saying, hey, folks, I think there's a strong case here for a move up to 2750. Now, at the time, we were trading below 2650 when he first sent that letter out. And he said, people in his network are telling him that there's rumors that there could be a QT policy stance change or a reversal. And he made that call in his letter before the Fed meeting. So he warned people it was coming. And he said, if that happens, it's going to be a bullish pivot and it's going to be scary. So Charlie has totally nailed the call. It's true that the way things unfolded was not exactly as he described on this program 2 weeks ago. But if you're following his daily letters, he has been a step ahead of the market and doing extremely well for people who are trading his advice. So I just want to give Charlie credit there. So I really think that from start to finish, he has nailed it. He changed his view when the facts changed, and I think he got it. Now, as far as an update in today's letter, what Charlie reports is that the NASDAQ model is already flipping today from 71% short to 100% long. All eyes are on the one-year S&P model, which is still short, but it has a very good chance of flipping long on Tuesday of next week. And the reason he's able to predict Tuesday of next week is it's when some large samples come out of that trailing one-year sample period. So he's watching it very closely, and he does see a pivot back to bullish. But Charlie's overall commentary was very much in line with my own sentiment, which is, okay, it's got to go tactically into bullish sentiment. That's going to take us higher. I don't know if it's 2,800. I don't think Charlie actually had a target number published in today's letter, but he definitely did agree that, you know, that's for now. Eventually, what is all this doing? It's confirming the message that Charlie's been saying for a year now, which is the cycle is ending. If you look at his fear the steepener narrative, that's what's happening. And we saw the 530s spread move to a one-year high on today's news. So all of Charlie's longer-term analysis is playing out, and it's saying cycle is ending. But we're seeing what may be a last hurrah here. And to be sure, with this dovish policy pivot, it's got to mean that in the short term, all the screaming and yelling is going to be to the upside for stocks, for gold, downside for the dollar because of the Fed's pivot. In the long run, which I think is much more important, you've got to recognize what's really happening here is the Fed is running out of options. They're in trouble and it's showing. But for now, the market's going to respond to a dovish pivot with a move upside in risk assets. I predict this is going to end very badly in the end, but the end is not right now. We've got another wave up before this plays out. Remember that corporate buybacks are coming back into this short-term mania to the upside thinking, and they're probably going to propel this market higher. I look at this, Patrick, as an opportunity forthcoming to short this market from a much higher level. And I'm going to continue to watch Charlie's letter every day. We have, by the way, gotten quite a few inquiries and emails saying Charlie didn't explain. He said very clearly in the podcast that his letter is only available to Nomura's institutional clients. And he told you how to get it by contacting your Nomura representative. We don't understand why we're being flooded with emails from people saying, Charlie didn't explain how to get it if you're not a Nomura client. He did explain that. The answer is, unfortunately, you can't. Please forgive us for not responding to your emails. There's too many of you asking that same question that was already answered on the program. We don't have time to respond to all of them.
Well, Eric, I have to agree with you, though, on the S&P. The short-term path has to be that the dovish pivot is going to draw buying. But really, in my mind anyway, it does signal the fact that the global economy and the economy is slowing enough that the Fed sees that they have to kind of take their foot off the pedal a little bit and see how this plays out before they make their next move. Anyway, let's move on to the dollar, because that's really, in my mind, where the first reaction function was to the Fed, which is that the dollar broke to the downside. What's your thinking here? Do we head still lower on the dollar?
Well, actually, I'm surprised at how well it's holding up considering the news. I mean, yeah, we had a very sharp move to the downside, but this is an outright total change of story from the Fed. I would have expected a bigger move down. Now, I still think the bullish argument is there, very much there. But from a tactical standpoint, I would have said, okay, get ready for a pretty big pullback in the dollar before eventually that dollar liquidity squeeze argument kicks back in and we eventually resolve higher. So I'm surprised by how resilient the dollar has been. And I'll have more to say about that when we get to gold.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because this whole impulse of risk on drove a breakout to a little bit of a higher high, at least for the month of January on crude, but it seems to have backed off from there. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I sold that rally today. I went short from 55 spot 25. And I'll come back to that in a minute, but let's cover inventory first. Crude oil inventories building 916,000 barrels as opposed to about a 3.2 million barrel build expectation. So a miss there. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 145,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 2.2 million barrels. That's the biggest drawdown in about 3 months. Distillates drawing down 1.1 million barrels. So generally speaking, we had some pretty good bullish news that propelled the market above 55. Regular listeners will remember I've been saying for a while now, I think we're coming into a consolidation range here between around 45 and 55. We hit the very top end of that range above 55 today. I think that may be at least a short-term top. We'll see what happened. I sold it, hoping that it will be. Hopefully, I don't get stopped out if we move higher. Obviously, a geopolitical upset can change everything overnight in the oil market. But barring some kind of outside event, I think there's a pretty good case that maybe we've seen the short-term high and we're going to trade lower here. We'll see what happens, Patrick. But my inclination is to think that probably we've seen the upside for now. And the next question of my mind is, do we go back down to 45 or so and stay in this consolidation range, or is there room for a combination of bearish both economic news as well as inventory data to push us below 40, say? That's not my base case. My base case is a consolidation pattern. But either way, we're at the top of the range that I expect, and I think there's a good chance for a short trade to play out here.
Well, let's move on to gold, because that's where all the action seems to be on at least a relative momentum basis. A big breakout on gold above 1300 and seems to be having some traction here. Is this sustainable?
Well, as I've said for many weeks, if we saw a break above 1300 that stayed there for several days, it hasn't been several days yet, but I think it's probably headed in that direction. You can't ignore it anymore. It's time to take this seriously. So I do continue to feel that there is a bullish dollar argument, but with this accommodative reversal from Powell, I think it really portends higher equity prices, higher gold prices. And we'll see whether or not that plays out. I look at this, though, in terms of an opportunity to get into that pairs trade that I've described, long gold and long the dollar at the same time. And what I'm doing, and it's much overdue, frankly, is analyzing what the hedging ratios need to be. And that's not at all a trivial task. It's not simply a matter of going long five gold contracts and $5 index contracts. And it's not even a matter of figuring out what the equal notional principal amount is, because they're different contract sizes. What you've really got to do is look at a regression analysis of the historical volatility and the correlation that has existed between gold and the dollar, and figure out the right hedging ratio to put on that pairs trade. I haven't done that yet, but you know, we've got Kevin Muir joining us in postgame. I want to ask him, because I know he's looked at that trade too, and maybe he'll have a little bit of insight on the subject as well.
Sure. So let's move on to the 10-year treasury yields, because really we saw us up at the 280 level off that low, but how quickly treasury yields have come off, especially on this dovish pivot. What's your thinking here on the next direction of trends? Are we going lower than 250?
Well, Patrick, we're back to the middle of that narrow trading band between 2 spot 60 and 2 spot 80 that we've been watching for, looking for a signal as what should come next. And as you say, we touched 2 spot 80, then this news from the Fed has reversed things. I think in general, with seeing more and more recession signals, seeing that the Fed getting accommodative, suggesting that they're scared of what's coming in the economy, it all tends to suggest a downside resolution in yields. So it remains to be seen. I want to wait for a break decisively below 2 spot 60 before I'm convinced that the move is on. But I do think that that direction is more likely than the other direction. Definitely, though, it's time for us to get some more fixed income gurus on the show, because bond yields are going to be one of the most important things to watch in the world of macro. You know, we've been trying to get Jeff Gundlach on the program for more than a year. Maybe if everybody tweets at Truth Gundlach all at once and encourages him, we can get him on the show. If not, maybe we can get someone else from Double Line. And certainly, I know, Patrick, you're working on a number of potential bond guys from other firms as well. So let's see what we can get lined up in coming weeks.
That sounds like a plan. So this week's featured interview guest is Grant Williams. Now, Eric, why did we choose Grant this week for the featured interview?
Well, Patrick, Grant is a brilliant long-term vision kind of guy. And frankly, he's been shamed a little bit by the bulls for his longer-term bearish outlook. He's been the guy who's standing up saying, hey, everybody, look at trillions of dollars of negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. This is crazy. This is not sustainable. This has to portend some really awful outcome. He was the guy going all the way back to the Brexit vote saying, look, this is just the beginning. It's the beginning of a much larger social trend. And he's been laughed out of the room for a lot of people who thought he was crazy. And I don't think he's crazy. I think he's been early in a lot of his views. I think he's going to be proven right in the end about most of the things that he says. I do think he was early on some of his calls, but it feels to me like right now we're coming to the end of the cycle, and maybe it's time for a lot of Grant's views to start being proven right. And perhaps it's time, Patrick, that we'll find that Grant himself will be proven early as opposed to wrong, as some people said, with a lot of the views that he's expressed in the last few years. So it just feels like a really good time to get him back on the program and to get us thinking about some of the things he's been raising the caution flag about for years now.
Well, you know, Eric, the one thing I like about Grant, he's just such a great storyteller. So let's bring him on and see what he has to share with us. So Eric's interview with Grant Williams is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Grant Williams from Real Vision Television and, of course, the Things That Make You Go, newsletter. I do want to let our listeners know that we are recording a week early in order to accommodate travel schedules, so our discussion about the markets will be about a week old, so we were not aware of anything that's happened in the last week or so. But, Grant, I want to start with the big picture of markets, which doesn't really have to be timely, which is, okay, look, a lot of people, myself included, have said over and over again, this bull market is long in the tooth. It's the longest one in history. It's due to end. And we were proven wrong several times over and surprised by yet another round of all-time highs. Have we finally gotten there? Is the top end for this cycle? And are we into at least a cyclical bear market? Or do you think maybe there's a chance that one more time I'll be proven wrong and we'll get pushed to new highs?
Well, you know what, Eric, you're not alone. I mean, a lot of us have been saying that we think we've seen the top of this market for a while now, and it has proved us wrong. It's like the guy in the Halloween movie. You think you kill it off, and it keeps coming back somehow. You know, to me though, looking across the landscape, it kind of feels a little different this time. I hate saying this time is different, but it just feels as though the impetus for new highs now, it's not going to be earnings. It doesn't feel like it's going to be purely based on Fed policy. It definitely doesn't feel like it's going to be a strengthening economy. So when you look at the things that have caused the surprise for us and have made us, let's face it, flat out wrong for a while now, I don't see an obvious catalyst for higher highs other than the Fed reversing policy. You know, Powell basically chickening out. And I will say, I sent a tweet out. It said four words. It said, I like Jay Powell. There, I've said it. And that marked the top in his hawkish policy, literally almost to the day. But if he backs down, you know, we may get a reaction from the market who might think, hey, the good times are here again. But I think that will wear off very quickly. And then people are going to start looking at the economy. And everywhere you look now, there are warnings coming out. There's Seth Klarman wrote a great letter with a very strong warning about the economy. A lot of the IMFs, the OECD, they're all kind of warning about problems of growth. We're seeing what's going on in China. So this time, everywhere you look, when you try and piece together a reason for markets to make new highs again, the only reasons I'm seeing are a change in the Fed policy, which I don't think is going to cut it this time because it's going to happen against the backdrop of a weakening economy, and a short squeeze, you know, a melt-up short squeeze. And I just don't see that happening. So I think we're bumbling around the top. Could we go up from here? Yep, but I think it'll be a bull trap. And I think ultimately the direction's changed and the path of least resistance now is lower.
The other big one is bond yields. We had so many smart people, whether it was Jeff Gundlach, our mutual friend Julian Brigden, had told us, look, if you see a break of that 100-month moving average on the 30-year Treasury bond, that's a trend that has been in play since the mid-1980s. It's a major signal. Sure enough, we got that signal. A lot of people were saying it's the break above 3.12 or so on the 10-year. We got that signal. And so many people said, once you see that break, it's no turning back. You're never going to see Treasury yields this low again for 30 or 40 years. And of course, it took 30 or 40 days before we had seen a reversal of that. And as we're speaking, what now is a week ago for our listeners, we're back in between that 260 and 280 range again, sort of chomping around here. Where do you think we're headed? Is Lacey Hunt and Ralph Paul about to be proven right that maybe we really are headed below that 1.34, which so far has been the low yield on the 10-year? Or is this just a temporary pullback before Gundlach and Brigden and others are proven right?
Well, this is the really interesting thing to me. And this to me is where when people say, well, where's all the damage that's been done by the last 10 years of monetary policy? And this, to me, is exactly where you're going to figure out what's happened. Because I think the short answer is I think they're both right. And I think in a normally functioning market, I think Jeff and Julian and the guys that are calling for inflationary pressures and higher yields are absolutely correct. But what no one was really counting on is the fact that if that happens against a global slowdown, you are going to have these weird kind of dynamics going on where the built-up inflationary pressures could be unleashed for a period of time at the same time that the market is going into a massive slowdown. And I think the panic that you're going to see ultimately will possibly drive treasuries down. I think Lacey and Raoul will be proven right. But once this breaks and confidence goes, once the panic grab for, and I use the air quotes, safety is over and people have got their treasuries, I think the economy is going to start to matter. More importantly, the U.S.'s finances are going to matter. And that's the point where this whole thing breaks. And I'm sure you and I are going to talk about some of the bigger picture issues, that the strains on the system. But make no mistake about it, this is definitely one of them. The U.S.'s finance haven't, they just haven't mattered. No one's really cared as the deficit's gone screaming up and the national debt has gone through $21 trillion. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But the day that matters, that's when you're going to see, I think, the Treasury yields go much, much higher from here. But I, as I say, the short answer, I think in the short term, I think Raoul and Lacey could well be proven right.
You know, this makes me wonder if we think 10, 20 years ago, what happened in Japan. So many people in finance were saying, okay, look, Japan is so over indebted, the blow up of their stock market bubble in 89. This is all leading to a massive collapse of JGBs. We're going to see the yield blow out astronomically as everybody realizes the default risk is through the roof and, you know, it's time to short JGBs, back the leverage truck up. That's it, baby. And what happened for decades is so many people made that argument, which frankly was a good argument on the face of it. The logic all made sense. But instead what happened is Japan found itself in economic stagnation that has lasted for decades. And I wonder if it's a precursor, if the whole world is about to turn Japanese, where per Lacey Hunt, we've got so much debt that we can't get back to historical normal yields. And we just go to a very low yield, low growth, stagnation environment globally that continues until we get to the point where there's either some populist uprising or something that resets the system. Is that a realistic scenario to consider?
Yeah, in my mind it is, but particularly the populist uprising, and I'm sure we'll come on and talk about that. But I've talked about this fairly often, that this Japanification of the world, there's two differences to think about. One is the fact that the Japanese bond market is essentially completely domestic. People overseas don't tend to own Japanese bonds. And secondly, as Japan went into its nosedive, there were other countries picking up the baton for growth. You know, you had, at that point, you had China growing double digits. You had India growing double digits. You had the U.S. doing pretty well. So there were other countries that could kind of carry the torch, and there was organic growth in the world. So people had a place to go, and the Japanese bond market just didn't really matter to anybody. I mean, you know, now there are days when the whole thing doesn't trade. I mean, it's farcical if you think about it, but it's really kind of just become a sideshow. If we go into a period where the U.S. sees no growth and China is down at four and struggling and having to bail out its banking system, and India kind of hasn't come through with as people thought it did, even though we're seeing growth in the monsoon countries, which again is something Raoul spoke about, and he and I did a presentation about this a couple of years ago, that's not enough. Those countries, growth in Ethiopia is not going to help the rest of the world pick up the load. It's going to be a completely different backdrop. And so I think this idea of a Japanification of the world is a little misguided. I think it's going to matter that this is a coordinated global slowdown as opposed to a Japan-specific thing. And I don't think that's something that is going to be looked past by bond investors.
I was reading things that make you go, on the airplane on the way to Vancouver the other day. And I was particularly interested in your article on China and Taiwan, because I'm not really an expert on all of these, China and all of its territories. I know quite a bit about Hong Kong just because I'm a resident there. But, you know, as much as they're saying, and you've covered this in your newsletter, okay, China has got to unify Taiwan with mainland China. They've got to toe the line, become part of the mainstream. No more independence. Haven't they been saying some version of that for like 25 years? And why would we believe that suddenly right now is the time that they're actually going to enforce that, and perhaps it is about to come to a head?
Funny you say that. The reason I included that in the letter was not so much the story, because you're right, that's been something that we have been talking about. I mean, when I was out in working out in Hong Kong, was when the Taiwanese held elections, you know, and there was a big fuss about it then, the Chinese talking about it, they can't do this. For me, it's more about the timing. You know, the fact that Xi Jinping is now making that a key plank of his policy tells you, I think, how much trouble the Chinese economy is in. Because if he's suddenly trying to say, hey, you know what, everybody, forget the economy, look over here and let's try and reunify China. This is classic. It's a classic tactic, you know, populism, reunification, nationalism. So for me, it's not the story. The story has been there, and it's been floating around, as you said, for years. What is interesting is that Xi is trying to focus attention on it again. And that, to me, is just a distraction sign. It's the economy is in real trouble. So I need to galvanize people around a reunified China again, because that kind of plays well. The fact that they haven't mentioned it in years because everything's been going fine tells you everything you need to know. So to me, it's not the fact that they're going to change their policy, but they're bringing that back to the fore because they see problems coming. And look, you don't know. The problem is always miscalculation. All the tactics that the politicians are using, whether it's Trump in the US or, you know, Cameron obviously made a massive miscalculation with the Brexit referendum. Miscalculation is what leads to problems politically. And who knows, if she does bring this back to the fore and the people really get behind it, particularly in the face of a weakening economy, you just don't know what he might do to try and unite the country behind him. So I think it's an important story to watch. I don't think you're going to see any action on it, but watching how hard they try and push it to the fore is a really, really useful indicator for just how weak that Chinese economy is. Because, as you and I both know, the data never really tells the full story.
Another subject that you covered in your most recent Things That Make You Go, newsletter was Australian real estate. And this one particularly interests me because so many of us were right about this and just way too early. And in this business, early is wrong. I helped to organize a trader group in Hong Kong in 2010. And one of our big topics was, how do you short Australian real estate? And needless to say, we were 8 years early and therefore wrong. And I guess my question now is twofold. One is, one of the problems is nobody could figure out, you know, do you just short the bank stocks? And how is the weakness that we knew was coming in Australian real estate, because it's clearly a bubble, how is it going to translate, and how effective is something like a short on banking stocks going to be to capture it? And of course, the other question was the timing. Well, the timing seems to have resolved itself. We know there's been a significant pullback. How well has that translated in terms of any tradable strategy? And do you think that, you know, I guess a lot of people would say, well, they've had, what is it, a 20% or something pullback on the price of properties in some cities? A lot of people would say, okay, that's their correction. It's over. It's a time to buy the dip. Is it just getting started with Australian real estate? And how do you play it?
It's a fascinating story. Like you, this is something I've watched for a while. I lived in Australia for a number of years, and even back in sort of 2005 through 2010, the market was nuts. You know, in 2008, when the crisis hit, the very first action that the Aussie government took was to give a $6,000 windfall to anyone buying their first home, because they understood just how fundamentally important that housing market is to Australia, to Australians. I mean, it's the whole ball of wax. So if you look at a chart of Australian housing, you'll see a tiny dip in 08, and then it went straight up again. And if you put that chart up against the U.S. housing market, you'll see it's so much higher than the U.S. was before the crisis in 2007, 2008, as to be almost laughable. And the entire Australian economy essentially revolves around that housing market. So you can understand why they've been defending it tooth and nail. You can understand almost why the bears have been wrong for such a long time. And a lot of that is to do with finding ways to be able to play the short. But there are a couple of things that happened which are starting to make it really, really interesting. And that is, first of all, the Commission on Finance, which was called a Royal Commission into Banking and Finance, was called. And this was again, politics. And when I talk about miscalculations, here's a prime example. The incumbent party have presided and been talking about how great the housing market have been. The opposition have been talking about how unaffordable housing has been. And they promised that if they got in, they would address housing affordability. And literally one MP was kicked out of his seat for personal transgressions. And that lost the majority for the government in parliament. And the opposition was able to force through this Banking and Finance Commission. Now, what that's done is start a whole set of dominoes toppling, because guess what? When they looked into banking and finance, they found out that all the stuff that was going on in the US with liar loans and forged documents, you know, all of that stuff was all happening in Australia. And the banks were up to their necks in it, as you knew they were going to be. I mean, this is the same problem. It's human nature. It's not going to be different anywhere else in the world. But once this thing started, the data that's been coming out of this Royal Commission, and it's an open commission, it's televised, you can watch it. It's been truly extraordinary. And so what's happened is the banks have cut back access to credit, and they've done it before they were told to by the commission. And so you've finally got a catalyst whereby the banks are stopping lending now to housing. And it's credit that has enabled this whole thing to go on, because housing is completely unaffordable. Unless you've got access to cheap credit, it just doesn't work. So this is all still going on. The pig is still going through the python, but you've finally got a catalyst. Now, the problem with shorting the banks in Australia, it has been the size of the dividends. They pay massive dividends. The big four, National Australia Bank, Westpac, ANZ, and Commonwealth, pay huge dividends. So they're owned in all the public pension funds. And so it's been a really tough thing to battle against them, simply because people would just own them for the yield. But with this commission and with the restriction of credit, those dividends at some point are going to come under threat. And if they do cut the dividend, or even if it's just slightly, I mean, they may be forced to make significant cuts in the dividends. If that happens, then you'll see a cascade in these things, and suddenly the banks will just be in freefall. Now, against that backdrop, the other aspect of this, which makes it very, very interesting right now, is you know, we all know that Australia's gone a quarter of a century without a recession, but it now starts to look as though the Aussies might be staring their first recession in 26-odd years in the face. And if that happens along with this, then, I mean, this could be a disaster for the Australian stock market and, by extension, the housing market, because people are stretched. Housing affordability is appalling in Australia. So it's just one of those kind of perfect storms. And if we get the recession that looks like it's coming, and we get massive contraction in credit, which looks like it's either going to happen voluntarily at first and then be forced on by the Royal Commission, there's really no way out of that for Australia, particularly if the third part of this, which is the Chinese economy, goes into reverse. That's it for Australia. I mean, you can stick a fork in Aussie for the time being. It's still difficult to play the banks because they're down. They're 20-odd percent down off the tops, but you've still got this need to own them for the dividend. So this is something, you watch the Australian economic data, you watch what the banks are doing in terms of making reparations or in terms of adjusting to the pressure being put on them by the Housing and Finance Committee. Commission, but I think this trade is in play right now. There's a couple of guys, a great friend of mine, Michael Schneider, down in Australia, who you should definitely have on to talk about this. He's all over this. Bill Strong of Eskaton is also looking at this trade. I did a great interview with him for Real Vision about six, eight months ago, where we talked about this. But it's happening, and it's like all the other things that we've talked about, Eric, where we've been wrong for so long. This Aussie market, everybody's been wrong, but they've all been looking for the short. So I think once it starts playing out, which it is, you will see plenty of people that want to pile on this thing, which is just going to drive these things down further. So I think the trade's happening. I think there's a lot further to go, and I think people should be watching this very, very carefully.
Let's talk a little bit more about the first recession in 26 years. I know you are a serious student, as am I, of feedback loops and human beings and what tends to happen to people. You talk about the first recession in 6 or 7 years. It might be that it's a little bit out of people's mind and they got to refresh their memory of what that means. When you talk about the first recession in 26 years, you're talking about an entire society where the youngest generation has no concept of what a recession is. What does that mean in terms of people's reaction and potentially exacerbating the effects of that recession?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That's the problem, right? It's the overswing of the pendulum, if you like. We will go, it won't be a normal common or garden recession. You've got 26 years of imbalances built up that have been, let's face it, staved off. The Aussie economy was basically completely reliant upon China, and China happened to go big just as Aussie was weakening, which really kind of saved them from a recession a decade ago. But you're right. I mean, this is an entire generation that's gone without a recession. And so the danger is that when one happens, and we all know it's going to happen, maybe they get through this year somehow. I don't see it, but maybe they do. But it's coming. And when it comes, people are going to be shocked to see mass redundancies and housing markets fall and stock markets fall. They just haven't seen that before. So people won't know how to react. They won't know how to invest. They won't know how to position themselves. And so they will do everything out of a sense of panic, which always unsettles markets and causes them to overshoot. And if you look at the Australian market, you'll see it's way too expensive for a country that's going through what it's doing, but probably more importantly, the currency. You know, I think what you'll see is the Aussie dollar is going to go back to 50, and who knows, perhaps below that. I mean, that's probably where it should be. But the overshoot could be severe. So, the Aussie bond market and the Aussie currency markets, that's where I think there's some significant money to be made. And again, particularly the currency, because I think even where it is here, it's way overvalued.
Grant, you mentioned something a moment ago, which is that you and I and a lot of other smart people had been wrong about some things, or early at least, and we're now being proven right. There's one of these that I really wanted to be proven wrong on, and that is that for the last several years, you and I have predicted a dramatic increase in populism, social unrest, and violence. And a lot of people thought we were conspiracy theory nutcases. Now Paris is on fire. And I really, really would love you to tell me that I'm wrong to say that what we've predicted is starting, but I'm afraid that's what you're going to tell me.
Oh, boy, Eric, this is again, to me, this is the one that I hope and pray I'm wrong on. And I've been delighted to have been wrong for a while. I've been surprised by just how tolerant people have been. And I think that a lot of that has been politicians standing up and telling everybody how great everything's doing. And I think even when you've lost your own job, if you're being told that the economy is doing great and everything's fine and it's never been better, you hope that, maybe this is good. At least I'll be able to find myself another job. There's the old joke about the difference between a recession and a depression. It's a recession when your neighbor loses his job, and it's a depression when you lose yours. And that's what I fear. I think you'll find that after 08, people understand a lot more about finance than they did before 08. And they may not realize it, but I think they now understand bailouts. They understand how unfair bailouts are when they're targeted at Wall Street as opposed to Main Street. And I think what you're going to see, sadly, is the Fed and the government will do what they've always tried to do, which is bail out Wall Street to quote unquote save the system. Bernanke and Paulson managed to frighten lawmakers into passing TARP back in 08, $787 billion, which, I mean, is a drop in the bucket this time around. And even though people kind of thought it sounded wrong, they too were frightened by this whole, well, if we don't do this, the system's going to crash. If you have a bad economy and you have people feeling like they're disenfranchised and you tell them, you know what, we need to do this to save the system, well, suddenly the reaction changes, and the reaction is to hell with it. Let's burn the system to the ground, which I think is your point. And if we're in that place, which again, it feels like we are, populism is on the rise. The fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can float this 70% tax in the US and have all kinds of polls say that a lot of Americans are for it tells you that the attitude has changed. Bernie Sanders was the kind of tip of the spear in bringing this whole idea of socialism and fairness to a younger generation that haven't perhaps studied history or haven't lived through periods where they've seen the horrors that sort of socialism leading to communism can cause. I mean, I don't think anyone's really paying too much attention to Venezuela right now, even though it's a fantastic case in point as to what can happen when these things go wrong. But when things are bad, an alternative is always more appealing. Do you want the status quo, which you know is bad, or will you take a chance on something different? And of course, the big problem is people are saying that capitalism's failed. Well, we don't have capitalism anymore. We are not a capitalist society. We have crony capitalism, which is completely different. And so if we had capitalism where weak companies were allowed to fail and companies were allowed to go bankrupt and there was some kind of check and balance in the system, we wouldn't be having these problems. But again, the decisions made in the name of quote unquote defending the system and defending capitalism and bailing out Wall Street because it's in the best interest of Main Street, that's all going to come home to roost. And I think what you're seeing in France is, again, another symptom of that. We've seen it in the UK with the Brexit vote. Obviously, we Brits are all awfully polite until we're not. And right now we're in the polite stage. But again, you can see with some of the demonstrations, some of the marches, and that you can see the anger there. This story this past weekend, or a couple of weekends ago now, when this is going to go live, of the Native American protests and the young kid and the MAGA hat and the blowback from that story. And I watched that like everybody else and looked at the kind of smug smile on this kid's face and thought, oh, boy, can you believe this kid? But when you dig into the story, and it took a couple of days for the rest of it to come out, and you see there is another side of the story, and it's not as cut and dried as it looked at first blush. And so suddenly you're being forced to pick a side. and people are have already picked their side. Everything that happens, they see through their own prism, and it just drives both sides further apart. So when you have this chasm between left and right in politics, you have an economy that is running on fumes, you have a stock market that is potentially at all-time highs, and you have a moment in time where things like the national debt start to matter, I worry, like you do, Eric, that the only way that people are going to be able to express this is the way they're doing it in France now. And that is going to be a very, very bad outcome for one and all. You know, as we record this, we are at the beginning of Davos, and there couldn't be a worse time, if you ask me, to shine the spotlight on the elite, because that's what they are. And you know, some of the numbers coming out in the press is really interesting. We talk about now, whatever you read about Davos, it's all within the context of how much richer the world's 1% have gotten since 2008. And when you look at, there was a chart in Bloomberg that showed the richest men in the world and the percentage that their wealth has increased over the last decade. I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, Mark Zuckerberg's 2,000 times wealthier than he was. Mukesh Ambani, one of the big magnates in India, is up a couple hundred percent. Mark Benioff of Salesforce was up almost 1,000%. Jamie Dimon is 300% wealthier than he was back in 2008. And the fact that this is the angle that the press is starting to take on Bloomberg shows you that they realize that the way to get people to read, because right now in the world we live in, it's all about clicks. How do I get people to read my article? How do I get eyeballs on it for the advertising dollars? The way to get someone to read is to make a headline that is anti the world's elite. I think the headline was Davos billionaires keep getting richer. Back in 2018, Oxfam put out a study that said that 80-odd percent of the wealth generated in 2018 went to the richest 1% of the population. So these headlines just fuel this populism. And I think it's Gerald Celente that says when people have nothing to lose, they lose it. And that's where we're at, I think. So watch the coverage, watch the angle people are taking with the wealth divide. Because when you start to see headlines that really play into the anger of the 99%, you know that that tipping point is getting closer. And look, as we started this off saying, I hope you're wrong, I hope I'm wrong. But every day that goes by, I fear that we're going to be more right than we thought we were, and that's trouble.
Another headline that you had in your most recent letter was, if Macron fails, Europe fails. What precisely did you mean by that?
Macron was interesting, right? Macron came out of nowhere. Here we have an ex-Rothschild banker who was put up as the alternative to the very unpalatable to the establishment anyway, Marine Le Pen, whose party was at its inception a overt far-right party led by her father. And there's a man you can absolutely apply the word racist to. But those connotations, she tried to weaken those. The establishment tried to strengthen her association with right-wing racism. And so when she started to get some real traction in the polls, you know, François Hollande was an appalling president. And suddenly Marine Le Pen, if Marine Le Pen looks like a palatable alternative, you know that you've got a country facing problems. Well, guess what? The establishment pulled Macron out of nowhere. Young, handsome, erudite, very much in the Obama mold, who again, you know, before he got elected was a junior senator that many people hadn't really heard of. But he spoke well, he looked great, he was very presentable, he was stylish. And Macron was that in spades. The fact that he was an ex-Rothschild banker seemed to pass by most of the people voting for him. And he got in, and the establishment breathed a huge sigh of relief. But guess what? He's turned out to, again, be an appalling president. His approval ratings are, I don't know if I'm right in saying they're below Hollande, but they're down there with Hollande, which I thought would be a remarkably difficult thing to do, but he's achieved it with some ease. And so I think Macron, to me, represented the establishment's last roll of the dice. Now, here's a guy, we're going to put him in there, we're going to get him to say all the things we need him to say, and he's going to calm things down, and he's going to help this whole thing blow over, and nothing of the sort has happened. And I think that is representation of what you and I have been talking about this populist movement and the fact that they're not going to just go away and be placated. I think what's happened to Hollande in France is the absolute embodiment of that. So the fact that he is struggling. The fact that he is looking as though, I mean, let's face it, in years gone by, he would have already stepped down. Back when politicians had some shame, he would have already stepped down and taken responsibility for the state of the country. But they don't do that anymore. You know, Theresa May would have stepped down in years gone by, but she's refusing to do that despite various no confidence votes and being suffering a defeat in the Commons, the like of which has never been seen before in British Parliament. So the establishment is kicking and screaming against this natural move towards a reset. And I think if Macron fails, which I would argue that he already has, but failure these days is seen as you finally give in and step down. If that happens, then, you know, I think the establishment is under real, real trouble. And with that, Europe could see it go where I think it's been destined to go forever, which is back to individual European nations. You know, Italy is the other thing that people need to be watching very, very carefully, because this situation in Italy with the League, or the Northern League as they used to call themselves until they decided to get serious about uniting the country, and Five Star are playing for keeps, and they're not Greece. They do have clout in the middle of Europe, and I think if the Italians stick two fingers up at the EU, which more and more the response by the public to the way that the ruling party now are handling Europe tells you that's what the Italians want them to do. Everywhere you look, Europe is coming apart. And as always, the European politicians, the Junckers, the Tusks of the world are whistling past the graveyard, assuming that they have all the power and refusing to play ball. And everything is setting up for Europe to break. And I think Macron is... should he step down, that will be the catalyst for the whole thing to fall apart.
Let's take this a step deeper, because as we said before, it's so easy to come up with the catchy headline that gets clicks. Grant Williams says if Macron fails, Europe fails. That'll make Zero Hedge easily.
I walked into that.
I'm going to hold you accountable, because the folks on Zero Hedge who read beyond the headlines want to know more. What specifically do we mean? Let's suppose we get into this subject, which you predicted before the Brexit referendum was even voted on, which, as you said, it's inevitable. All the ingredients are in place for the European Union to eventually fail and go back to individual countries. Let's dive into the detail of how does that go. Does the currency start to fail, and then in reaction to failing currency, the countries kind of run for the exits and go back to their own currencies? Or is it not driven by the currency and it's political, and for political reasons, borders go back up? How does Europe fail? What precisely does that mean for the folks who read beyond the headline and want to know more?
Well, a failure of the EU is borders and individual currencies. That's the failure, because that's what they tried to do, is bring the continent together to create a continent, a federation of states, essentially, is what they wanted to create. And look, the reasons behind it were admirable. You know, we don't want another war in Europe. If we can unite the French and the Germans at the heart of Europe and make them partners in something, then hopefully we can stave off another conflict. And it's worked. Look, it's worked in terms of staving off conflict. But the EU and the euro, particularly as it was designed, was never going to work. The euro fiscal union has to be a part of monetary union. And people would say, well, you know, it worked just fine. Well, why is it not working now? Because we had everything going in the right direction. We had countries getting ridiculously low interest rates, Italy, Greece, Spain, that would never have been able to borrow at those rates absent the EU. And guess what they did? They borrowed as much as they possibly could. Are they going to pay it back? No, they never have. They wouldn't have been able to. So in a normally functioning world, they wouldn't have been lent that money at those rates, because the quote-unquote bank would have not lent it to them knowing they couldn't pay it back. So a failure of the EU is everybody has their own currency and everybody has a border again. Now, the key to this is going to be the euro, because it's the monetary union that is creating the problems now. It worked great when interest rates were going in the right direction. It worked great for everybody. Now they've started to go in the other direction, and the debts have started to matter, and the pressure is on these countries. You are going to suddenly see what being tied into this monetary union does. And if you throw in all the stuff we've been talking about, the strains economies are under, the fact that EU growth is now falling, it looks like we could have a recession in Europe as well. When recessions happen, people suddenly stop worrying about how great things were in the past, no one's going to say, well, you know what, the euro has been great to us for the last 19 years, so we'll give it a we'll cut it a break and we'll put up with some pain because it's done us so many favors. No, people don't understand what the euro represents, but they know that they can't make ends meet, and they know that an answer to this from a political standpoint is to go back to, I'll use Italy as an example, is to go back to the lira, pay off all your debts in lira, massively devalue your lira, and not be forced to maintain a budget deficit that is dictated by Brussels, and to be able to spend and help your country come out of a recession. That's what's going to happen. It was always going to happen. Once we get these conditions and politicians realize that they cannot do what they need to do domestically, forget international politics. This becomes domestic, and it always has done throughout history. Politics is always domestic first and international second. And they've clung on and clung on and clung on. But the way the bureaucrats in Brussels treat everybody, because they have to toe a hard line, they have to use the stick and not the carrot to keep this thing together, is going to be what breaks it. So I think we'll get a standoff, and either the EU will have to back down to Italy because Italy is just too big to say no to. Either they have to back down and cut Italy a break and allow them to blow out their budgets, which means everybody else is going to come and want the same thing, or they hold fast and miscalculate that the Italians will back down like the Greeks eventually did, and Italy says, you know what, we're big enough. We're a G7 country. We're not going to play your rules. We shouldn't have to do what you tell us. We're going to do what's best for Italy and Italians, you know, make Italy great again. And they go out. Now, the worst thing for Europe would be for the Italians to get out and be okay, or Brexit to happen and the Brits to be okay, because that will make the rest of Europe realize, well, what the hell are we doing here? Why don't we go back to our currency? So it's a series of dominoes toppling. It begins with the currency. Well, correction, it begins with politics, but the first brick in the wall that will be removed in Europe is going to be the currency. And everywhere I look, I see signs that day is headed towards us. Now, as you keep saying, Eric, we've been wrong for a long time. We have been. But inevitable and imminent are mutually exclusive often, and that has been the case with Europe. But again, I think if you're paying attention to the headlines and you're paying attention to the politics going on throughout the continent, you can see that it's bending, and it's bending so much that I suspect it's going to break.
One of the cardinal rules of financial podcasting is if you really want a socialist revolt, you have Grant Williams on your podcast and don't ask him about gold. I learned this once the hard way. So we better get, before we run out of time, to the punchline I know so many listeners are interested in. And I particularly want you to comment on an aspect of this. Certainly, for anybody who has been paying attention in the last few years, the reasons that gold is almost certain to have its day in the sun at some point should already be clear. The thing is, some of us have held the view that because we really see a very strong dollar liquidity squeeze argument, we fear that the dollar index is going to move higher. That's probably going to cause gold to move down in price before it eventually moves way up. And to be clear, I think the big move is up, but I kind of think there might be a little down left to go. And I really have felt like that view has played out very well. I still see the long argument for gold. It's always made sense, but you know, gold had been trading off very much in reciprocal action to the dollar index. Just over the last, really since about October 11th, when something snapped and the gold seemed almost like a peg to the Chinese yuan snapped, it seems like gold's acting a little differently. So I guess my question is, what do you think happened on October 11th that suddenly pulled gold out of correlation with the Chinese yuan? And are we perhaps to that point that your partner Raoul Paul predicted where, you know what, the dollar bulls are going to be right and the gold bulls are going to be right at the same time, both move up together? Are we at that point? And what happened? Something changed dramatically in the middle of October. Any idea what it was?
Well, look, I tell you, let's talk about what gold's day in the sun means, because I think it means different things to different people. To a lot of people who have been frustrated with gold, it's all about price. You know, they own gold because they think it should be $5,000, and they think they can sell it at $5,000 and double, triple, quadruple their money. to me, gold day in the sun is something completely different. The day in the sun is when gold actually does what it's supposed to do and protects your purchasing power. You know, it doesn't matter to me if gold goes down 10%, but markets halve. Great. Gold, holding gold has given me the ability to buy many, many more shares of the S&P than I would have been able to had I just held the dollar. So I don't look at the gold price so much. It's not so important to me. It's reflective of what's going on in markets, perhaps. It's reflective of sentiment. But I don't own gold because I want to turn it for a profit. I never have, and I would never buy it for that. So I kind of look at it a little bit differently. To me, the gold day in the sun is the day when I decide that I want to exchange my gold for something else, and I'm able to buy more of them than I would have been had I held cash. So I something clearly has changed. I have absolutely no idea what it is, because why gold would be for a period of time pegged to the Japanese yen and then for a period of time be pegged to the yuan, who knows, Eric? I mean, we could speculate about that all day long, and the beauty of gold is it gives the conspiracy theories something to really get their teeth into. But to me, it doesn't matter. I think you will see a rising dollar and rising gold. But for me, the next move in the dollar is down. My great friends Brent Johnson and Raoul Powell talk very eloquently about this dollar super shock where it spikes to levels that would make your eyes water. I don't think we're going to see it. And if we do see it, I think it will be stamped on so fast that you won't have time to get out of your position. I think the dollar is going to go lower. I think we're starting to see that now. And that will be good for gold, but it's not necessarily the only thing that's driving it. You know, I think gold is going to reach a point where if everything we've talked about in the last 45 odd minutes comes to pass, or certainly bubbles to the surface, if we get populism, if we get unrest, if we get falling markets, if we get the loss of confidence in the US government's finances, all of those things mean people will want to own gold. And the day that this whole thing really unwinds is when people will only settle for physical gold. They don't want paper anymore. They don't want a futures contract. They don't want an ETF. They want to own physical gold, because when that happens, that's when you're going to see the price do extraordinary things, because there simply isn't enough physical gold to satisfy all the paper promises on it. And I've talked about this. I've given presentations on it, but it hasn't mattered. And so if you really care about the price, it seems as though none of this is relevant. Because I don't care about the price so much, I care about the purchasing power. As I watch this rubber band get stretched further and further in terms of the world disintegrating and gold really not reflecting that, that to me says that on the day when people say, you know what, yeah, not so much with ETF, how do I buy a gold bar? The day that happens, you'll see some fireworks in the gold price that will satisfy all the people that have been waiting for it to do crazy things. But more importantly, the people who've put 5-10% of their wealth in gold as an insurance policy are going to be feeling a lot happier about the state of their finances if markets are melting down. So, you know, I don't know when it's coming. I try not to talk about the price or when, because as I said, it's irrelevant to me. But if you go back to 2008 and gold fell 15% in early 08, when markets fell 66%. And so you were able to exchange your gold for all kinds of things. You could exchange it for houses, you could exchange it for equities, and you could exchange it for a lot more houses and a lot more equities than you could before the meltdown happened. So this focus on the price, to me, is completely the wrong way to look at it. I think there are plenty of things you can buy if you want to try and make a 100% return. Doing it in gold is just a pointless exercise to me. So I think gold's quote unquote day in the sun is coming, but I think what that means is something different to a $2,500 gold price. It means gold is doing what it's supposed to do, and holding it is going to make you feel very, very happy as opposed to not having any.
Let's very briefly, before we close, just touch on the dollar, because I know, Grant, that you are very familiar with the argument that I've made, that Raoul has made, that Brent Johnson has made, which is, look, quantitative tightening just has to be dollar bullish, because every quantitative tightening Fed balance sheet roll-off is equivalent effectively to a rate hike. Is the issue that you disagree with our logic, or is the issue that you don't think quantitative tightening is going to continue?
I certainly understand your rationale. I don't disagree with the premise at all. I mean, I can absolutely see the linkage. I can see how it happens. I can see why a short squeeze could pick up momentum. But I think the damage that the scenario you guys lay out would cause would be so severe that it would have to get stopped. QT would be stopped. QE would be implemented. We'd have a Shanghai Accord of sorts. There would be an agreement to weaken the dollar by everybody because it's become so systemically important and the system is so fragile that it's in nobody's best interest for the dollar to strengthen significantly. It's not in the US best interest. It's certainly not in Asia's best interest. And so I can see what you say happening, but I think the speed with which they squash it will make your eyes water. And I don't even know you'll have a chance to get out of your trade. And QT, we've already seen Jay Powell come out with his Superman suit on and then walk it back very, very quickly. You know, all this talk about QT being an autopilot, well, he's back down from that pretty quick. They understand the damage that QT can do. Absolutely, they do. They understand the positive effects that QE has had. And I choose my words carefully because I think if they think it'll have the same effects next time, I think they're very much mistaken. I think they'll have to go much bigger, which won't be pleasant for the dollar. So, look, I think you could be right. I absolutely think you could be right. But I think you'll be right for a very, very short period of time. And I think you're going to be wrong first.
For the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with the argument and the premise that we're discussing, go back and listen to Brent Johnson's interview on this program just a few weeks ago to explain it. We are just about out of time, Grant, but before we go, we had such a fantastic experience with our second live event. It was such a grand success that Real Vision decided to not only copy the idea, but even copy the name. Tell us about Real Vision Live.
I'm not sure about the copy, Eric, but it's something we've been kicking around for a long, long time is to start doing live events. And we've had a lot of requests to do one. So next week in New York, February the 4th, we've got a workshop, which is going to be just tremendous fun. We've got Tommy Thornton, Tony Greer, myself, Raoul Powell, and Dave Floyd are all going to give interactive workshops and talk about what we do. And more importantly, how we do it. So, as opposed to PowerPoint presentations, it's going to be a workshop. We're going to help people understand Raoul's macro view, how he builds it, how Dave sets himself up to trade, how Tony reads charts, how Tommy Thornton puts it all together. So, if you come along to it, you will really get a masterclass from a bunch of guys that have great frameworks and are going to share them with you. So, you can find out more at realvision.com. It's February the 4th in New York City, and it's going to be an awful lot of fun, I think.
Fantastic. We're going to need to leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Grant on the show. But now in the postgame, joining us is my good friend, Kevin Muir. How you doing, Kev?
Great. It's good to be with you guys.
Great. So, Kev, listen, we just wanted to start off by asking you, what was your impression or what did you take away from the last Fed announcement?
Well, going into the announcement, I thought there was no way that Powell would find a way to be more dovish than the already dovish expectations. And I was completely wrong. He astounded us all by going even more dovish.
Very well said, Kevin. And, you know, I would go even a step farther and say it's not only dovish, it's proven to us that what Powell said when he took office, which is they're not going to cave to markets, they're not going to adjust their policy in order to react to markets having a temper tantrum, that was BS. They are going to react to markets. That's what they're doing now. It's pretty clear. And what it really brings to my mind is this question of where the trade is, because let's face it, people like myself who were convinced announced that Powell was going to stay the course on QT, just got caught wrong-footed. If you had been either flat or short gold, and I was flat going into this announcement because you thought they were going to stay the course on QT, and if you had been long the dollar for reasons that I've described in the program, you got nailed. But what I think would work here is if you had been, and you get the ratios right, long the dollar and long gold at the same time. Gold really saw a pop here, and the dollar actually took less of a hit than I thought. And if this had gone the other way, I think the dollar could have been big to the upside, while gold maybe would have been a little bit muted on the downside, because we've been seeing gold outperform its usual inverse relationship to the dollar. As you know, because you've worked on an institutional desk, this is not a matter of just saying the trade is long five gold contracts or five shares of a gold ETF and long five shares of a something like UUP, which is the bullish dollar index ETF. You've got to calculate hedging ratios based on past correlation ratios, and that's an analysis function that requires a little bit of work. I know you're good at this stuff. Are you a step ahead of me? Do I need to do that work, or have you already done it?
Eric, that's a great question, and there's no doubt that gold has rallied stronger than the dollar has gone down. When you see the charts, you can see that gold's running like it stole something, and the dollar's had some, you know, it sagged a little, but it really hasn't been that bad. So it's been a terrific trade to be long the gold as well as being long the dollar. And in terms of what the exact ratio is, that's moving bet. Like, it's always changing. The correlations are changing. And it's something that we should do a little work on, and maybe we can get back to you on that.
Well, I'll tell you what. You guys have been running, I think you're on your 12th or 13th episode of the Market Huddle, which is a video-enhanced conversation that you guys have been doing. You invited me to be on your show on Saturday. Have you got time to work up a couple of charts? Because what I would love to see is not only the hedging ratios that you think are appropriate, but then if you plot the performance of that trade, long X number of shares or contracts or whatever it is of gold and long a bullish dollar product like UUP or DX futures, if you come up with that ratio, how does that chart look and how has it performed in the last few months? I wouldn't be surprised to find that from a technical standpoint, that pairs trade actually is a pretty bullish looking chart, but I'm doing that intuitively. Can we do that for Saturday release?
Sure, that sounds great. Sounds like a terrific trade. We get you on the huddle and I do a little work on the ratio.
Sounds fantastic.
Those of our listeners that are not familiar with the Market Huddle, Kevin Muir and myself have launched a little YouTube show. So you can just go on to YouTube and type in Market Huddle and you can view all the last few episodes. Nonetheless, let's move on. Kevin, you wrote a great blog on MMT, on modern monetary theory. And without me kind of spoiling it, why don't you give us a quick rundown of what your thoughts were on this?
Well, let me go back first and go to the kind of the origins of why I wrote this blog. About a year ago, I started to see this MMT up on the Twitter and I saw people talking about it. And I was a little embarrassed to kind of realize that, you know, although I knew what it stood for, modern monetary theory, I didn't really understand what it meant and how it differed from other kind of economic theories. So what I did was I reached out to George Perks at the Bespoke and he kind of passed me on to Stephanie Kelton, which is really the face of MMT. She's a professor at Stony Brook University. And I just started digging and it was just fascinating stuff. And, you know, I put together a blog piece of all of my journey in terms of learning about MMT. And I included all those different kind of resources that I found while I was exploring this topic.
Well, Kevin, as you said in the opening of the piece, if there is one macro tourist blog post that you're going to make time to read this year, this should be it. And I really, really want to applaud you for the approach that you took because you do an excellent job of trying to help people like me who have a strong personal bias. I don't like the idea of what MMT is all about, and I think the way that you described it is essentially the view that governments should be at liberty to deficit spend all they want. Deficits don't matter. Governments have an unlimited ability to create more money. The only risk that really exists when they create more money is that of inflation, which is very true. And since right now we've had a deflationary backdrop, the MMT crowd led by Stephanie Kelton holds the view that, hey, if you've got a deflationary backdrop, it's a license for the government to print all kinds of money like it's going out of style and deficit spend to their heart's content. Now, I personally couldn't disagree more strongly with the notion that that's a good idea. I respectfully disagree with Professor Kelton on almost everything that she says. But what you really brought home in that article, and what I think is so important, is my personal view doesn't matter. I don't like socialism either, but you know what? The trend in society is away from capitalism towards socialism. The trend in society is very much that more and more people are embracing MMT and really feel like it's the right economic model. The idea that governments ought to embrace the opportunity to deficit spend to their heart's content. And I believe Professor Kelton even makes the argument that in her eyes, it's unethical for them not to spend excessively because it's an opportunity to help all sorts of people during an economic backdrop when inflation is not likely to occur right away. The reasons I disagree so strongly with that are not important. What is important is this is the trend. This is what's happening. Other people, and there's more of them than there are of me, think this is a wonderful idea. And I think we're going to see a lot more political sentiment growing around embracing MMT as the economic theory basis of this whole democratic socialist movement that is really taking the United States by storm. I think it's all very bad for humanity and society and the world. It doesn't matter what I think. It's happening and it's real. And as an investor, you've got to get your head around the fact that whether you like it or not, this is the way things are going. And you've got to really think then, whether you approve or not, what the consequences and implications are going to be for financial markets.
I'm going to actually interject here because I wanted to just take one step back and explain one further thing to our listeners that they may not have gotten. And either of you can correct me if I'm wrong, but currently money, the vast majority of money is created first through the monetary base at the central bank level, but then through the credit creation through the main money center banks. And so almost all money is financed through the bond markets. But the idea being floated by MMT is this idea of changing the rules, and this idea that essentially governments can run big deficits and go directly to central banks that will fund the shortfall by just simply printing money. And to me, that's a complete game changer. Am I right in my interpretation of that?
Well, it's Kevin here. So both of you are still thinking about everything from a kind of an old economic vision. And before Eric mentioned something about this being the domain of left-wing kind of crowd, I do want to point out one thing. There's actually some right-wing Wall Street guys that are behind this. Like, for example, Warren Mosler, who was an ex-hedge fund trader who actually ran for president, he's a big advocate of MMT. And interestingly enough, I found this other guy when I was doing my research, which is Glenn Haddon, which is one of the biggest bond traders on Wall Street. He used to work at Goldman Sachs, and he eventually ended up at Morgan Stanley. He also is a big advocate of MMT. So it's not just the left that is embracing this policy. And, you know, Ben Hunt from Epsilon Theory, he had a great blog piece, and he kind of predicted that it would also gain traction. And one of the reasons he predicted it would gain traction is because it was going to be liked by both the left and the right. Because as you say, it does give politicians more license to print more, not print, but to spend more money. And so that's the first point I would like to make. Now, in terms of the idea that this is just going to be unlimited and that there's no restraint on the government, I think that's also kind of a false notion. What they're saying is that the idea that the constraint on government spending is a budget meaning it's like a nominal financial restraint, is wrong. What it is it's a real constraint. So in real terms, if the society is running and there's excess capacity in it, it makes sense to try to use that capacity in any way we can. So what they're trying to argue is, why should we not spend if there's underutilized capacity within the economy? That spending will actually create a higher GDP and will actually be better. And it's also kind of counterintuitive in that they argue that the government needs to spend first because they are the issuer of the currency. And that currency getting created is actually has to be done by the government. And so the government's spending has to come before the borrowing. And so listen, I'm not smart enough to figure all these things out in terms of like my mind races and kind of my eyes go, you know, out to the top of my head when I start listening to all these things. And it gets very sophisticated in terms of the difference between a Keynesian and a MMT guy. But I agree with Eric in that the big picture is that we are going to find that more and more people are going to embrace this sort of thinking, and that we were always wondering, where was inflation going to come from? And I always thought that was kind of such a funny thing when people would tell me, there's no way that the government is going to create inflation. There's too much debt out there. And I always said, with a political will, the governments can always create inflation. And there was always this kind of pushback. They said, no, we can't create inflation because we can't figure out where the money comes from to spend. Well, MMT is now presenting us with kind of the idea that the government doesn't need to figure out where the money is first before they spend. And that really it's only inflation that will hold us back. So I do agree with Eric that ultimately inflation will be a problem. Like in most things, it will be a good idea that's taken much too far. But I kind of push back on the idea that it's as bad and as ominous as Eric is making it out to be.
Well, my real point was not how bad I think it is. My point was whether you agree or disagree with me. It's coming. This is the trend. This is what's catching on. And whether you agree with it or disagree with it isn't that important from an investing standpoint. What is important is to know that this is what the trend is. But I can't resist, since we were on the subject, Kevin, and you seem to understand this pretty well. Help me understand what seems to be missing from everything I've read on it, which is, if what Professor Kelton is advocating is in an environment, basically the argument is you can print as much money as you want to, and the risk is inflation, and so therefore if the inflation is not happening right now, there's nothing wrong with printing right now. If that's the case, why don't we stimulate the economy by cutting all taxes to zero and deficit spending on everything? We know for a fact that cutting taxes is an effective fiscal stimulant that will dramatically improve the economy. Why wouldn't we just eliminate taxes if this is true?
Well, she would argue that it's a societal choice of whether we deficit spend or cut taxes, but it's not like MMTers are against cutting taxes. That's the other thing, that people believe that MMTers somehow believe that the 70% tax rate that's being kind of thrown about for the top marginal rate is something that they agree with. That is not what they agree with. All they are saying is that the constraint isn't a kind of a financial constraint. It is a real constraint. And when the economy has underutilized capacity, it almost kind of seems counterintuitive to not use it. It's resources that are going to waste. Now, listen, I'm not smart enough to figure out if this is something that's going to work in the long run. And I never kind of wrote my piece trying to say I am an MMTer and this is what I believe in. I wrote my piece basically from what you said, is that I believe that this is gaining more and more traction. It's something that young people really love. It's something that they can get their heads wrapped around. It's also an interesting thing. After I wrote my piece, I was surprised at how many kind of closet MMTers there are out there. And I'm talking big time money managers that kind of emailed me and said, I actually believe in this. This is something that I think is correct, and I think that we should do it. So I think there's a kind of an underground movement, and that is only going to increase, and we are going to see this kind of pick up steam, and it'll come out, and more people will come out of the closet, so to speak, and admit that they're MMTers.
You know, what my pushback on this, I mean, this is redefining what we define as money. I mean, this changes the game. This is, in my mind, almost like a Pandora's box. Is once we go down this road, there's no going back. And what if there are things like when you, the only constraint is inflation, really the question becomes, how do you really put a limit on a government in terms of how far they take this? Like, once you allow this to become a way from which we conduct monetary policy, I don't know. To me, I'm not sold on it anyway.
Well, so that's my biggest pushback as well. It's easy to go in the government to create inflation. The more difficult thing will be to slow it down when they finally start competing with the private sector and pushing inflation up. And governments are, you know, it's always easier to spend more. It's more difficult to cut something back. And that's kind of my pushback. MMTers would tell you that they would advocate all sorts of programs that were automatically stabilizing the economy, meaning that they cut back as inflation takes off. And guys, there's a huge amount of debate. And even amongst the MMT community, it's not something that is agreed upon. It is still a kind of a policy that hasn't really been tried in the real world in terms of actually being implemented full on. And so it's something that we're going to see that there's the debate of what it exactly looks like will vary as we proceed down this path. But make no mistake, I believe that we are headed down this path. And Eric is right in that you need to start thinking about this from your portfolio perspective, because regardless of whether you think it's good or bad, I think it's coming.
Well, you know, that's a pretty solid case for the long-term bullishness on gold, that's for sure.
And I cannot possibly echo you strongly enough. This is not about whether you or I think it's a good idea. It's about a really big picture social trend change, where I think that MMT is going to become the monetary theory of the Democratic Socialist Party, which I expect will be stronger than the old school Democratic Party before we know it here. And I don't happen to agree with those things. Some of our listeners might agree with those, and I certainly respect your view. But again, it's not about whether I disagree or you do agree. It's about whether or not this is a big trend that is going to change markets, and I'm convinced that it is.
Yeah, well, I would say one thing to Eric. What if Trump beats the Democrats to it? Think about that.
Oh, if Trump, who is very comfortable with debt, decides to make MMT his baby so that the Democratic Socialists can't claim it as theirs, that would be an interesting scenario. Certainly that could play out. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I can't help but come back to the big picture. We've got more than $20 trillion of debt, more than 100% debt to GDP. And you get to that point and you decide, okay, we're not creating debt fast enough. We need to borrow and spend more recklessly. That's the solution to our problems. Does not register for me, but I think that my strongest prediction is that the inflation that the MMTers keep talking about as a limiting factor, they will create their inflation. And because there's such a big lag effect in inflation, by the time that their controls kick in that automatically cut back, it will be too late. They will have created a tidal wave before they really register it on their radar screens as happening. But, you know, I could be wrong about that. It doesn't matter. This is the trend. And I think that in general, as Luke Groman said on this program, if you don't like Donald Trump, wait till you see the next guy they elect. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see the 2020 election is going to be profoundly important to markets. And the policy that we move forward with is going to be socially influenced. I was very surprised when Louis Gav was, you know, just completely shocked when I said, what if we see that whatever the Fed wants to do next is vetoed by the people who say, you know, we're not going to let the Fed bail out Wall Street again. And they're literally rioting in the streets. And Louis thought I was crazy to say rioting in the streets. Well, look at what they're burning Paris down. And it's not moved to the United States yet, but I think it's coming. And these social changes and these mood changes and these philosophical changes in the way government should be organized are going to have profound effects on markets. They're really big trends, and I think that they're unstoppable. But in the interest of time, guys, we're going to have to leave it here. I do want to continue the conversation. So the market huddle will be where we can pick up this conversation. You've generously invited me to participate in this new program of yours on Saturday. Tell our listeners who are not already familiar with it, Patrick, what is the market huddle? Where did it come from? What are you trying to accomplish? And where can they tune in?
Eric, you know, I love co-hosting Macro Voices with you, but I've been for many months getting together with Kevin, having a beer and just talking about the markets. And we said, hey, you know, we should just get onto YouTube and create a show where we chat about putting on trades and what's going on in the markets, what we think is happening, and just have a great time. So we crack open a beer on a YouTube show here, and we just talk about some of the really fun stuff going on in the markets. And Kev's a lot of fun to do it with, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and we have the occasional guest, and it's good to have you on, Eric. We're looking forward to it, and it's something that's a little more lighthearted than a lot of other ones. We try to, you know, remember and be a little more. We poke fun at each other and of ourselves, so it's something that makes for some great kind of weekend watching.
And where can people tune in?
Listeners can find it just by going to the website at www.markethuddle.com or just the YouTube Market Huddle on YouTube.
Well, Kevin, thanks for joining us on the program. We're going to need to leave it there in the interest of time. I do have a request for our listeners. We're trying to grow Macro Voices and get more listeners. We find that the best way to do that is for me to appear on other podcast shows. That gets people that are into podcasting to become aware of Macro Voices. So my request to everyone listening is to write to the producers of your other favorite podcasts, whether they be political, financial, or otherwise, and encourage them to invite me, Eric Townsend, on their show as a guest, because that will help us to source even more listeners for Macro Voices. The more that we grow, the more that we're able to bring you a better show every single week, get more feature interview guests, and deliver even more great content in your Research Roundup emails. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Grant, as well as a link to Kevin Muir's blog on modern monetary theory. There's also an interesting article in that same theme from Paul Krugman on MMT again, as well as an article discussing George Soros talking about the U.S. and China Cold War threatening to turn into a hot one. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors.
Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.